More people than ever are enjoying Iowa's trails and waterways, but the future expansion of bike trails, water trails, and other outdoor recreational spaces is at risk. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we'll talk about how people are using these outdoor spaces and why they matter. We'll look to the future and talk about how budget cuts threaten future expansion and also raise questions about maintenance. I'll talk with Brian Morelli of the Cedar Rapids Gazette, Ruth Dunleavy of Backwater Paddlers, and Molly Hansen of Iowa Rivers Revival. Later in the hour, Eric Straw has set out to paddle his canoe in all 50 states. He'll tell us about his experiences. Join the conversation after the news.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. From the Whitewater Course in Charles City to the High Trestle Trail in Madrid and beyond, Iowa has invested in bike trails, water trails, and other outdoor recreational spaces. But budget cuts threaten to reverse that trend. These spaces, why they matter, and what the future holds will be one of the topics explored at the Iowa Ideas Conference in downtown Cedar Rapids on September 20th through the 22nd. The conference is organized by the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Iowa Public Radio is a media sponsor of the event. And Brian Morelli is a reporter for the Gazette. He'll be facilitating a panel on this topic. Hello, Brian.
Hi, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
And in addition to being a reporter, you are also an avid outdoors person, and you teach education courses on outdoor education at the University of Iowa. I'd love to hear, before we kind of dive into what's going on right now, from your personal perspective, how have you seen the landscape change in Iowa over the past decade or so as far as trails, both on rivers and other kinds of trails?
I mean, I would say I'm probably one of the people that has been drawn to go explore the outdoors in Iowa because of some of the investments that have been made in recent years to bike trails and water trails. It's one of those things that I sort of, kind of dipped my feet into and, got familiar with it, learned, where to go and kind of how to access some of these places and really kind of ran with it. So, I mean, I think there's been a lot of improvements in recent years.
Well, and as a reporter, a lot of these trail investments have also benefited some of the small communities that happen to be along these trails or worked really hard to be along these trails, right?
Well, yeah, it's kind of in my reporting, it was very interesting to learn about all these really small communities who are kind of fighting to get kind of linked up to some of these larger statewide trail systems, particularly for bike trails, but also river trails as well. You can't control where the river goes, but you can sort of modify your town to embrace the river and make the river more accessible, like we've seen in Charles City and Manchester and some of these other places around the state.
Absolutely. And of course, it's really difficult to count the number of people who are spending time on Iowa's waterways or even to count the people on bike trails. But there has been a significant increase, right?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of hard to quantify because a lot of these are, they're not controlled access points. But there are some indicators, like, for example, the water trails, aside from, just kind of looking outside and driving down the street and seeing, every fifth or sixth car with a kayak on it as you drive down Interstate 80 and some of the state highways, I learned that the number, I'm trying to find a number here, but the number of outfitters supporting paddling has really increased in the last 10 years. It's gone from, 24 in 2004 to about 80 in the present. So it really seems to be, commerce goes where the market is, right? So, I mean, that's one sign. And certainly bike shops, we're seeing a lot more bike shops and businesses along bike trails. We see it a lot on the around Des Moines on the High Trestle Trail. Some of those towns like Madrid and Slater, really, the businesses on the trail are always pretty busy.
Right. And so we've seen a real economic boost for some of these communities. And as far as the Iowa tourism industry goes, I mean, there's been a real push to communicate with people about these outdoor spaces, not just, of course, for people coming here from out of state, but to get people in Iowa to spend their vacation dollars here as well, right?
Yeah, to me, that's one of the most interesting parts of this is people don't necessarily think of Iowa as for all of its outdoor amenities, but the Iowa Tourism Bureau does surveys of visitors, and the Iowa Outdoors was consistently the first or second top reason people said they were coming to Iowa, and as far as what they were interested in doing while they were here.
So so whether or not it's the reason that they're coming, it's something that they're enjoying while they're in the state.
Yeah, absolutely. Nature, scenic, and outdoor adventure were the number one and three interests for travelers to Iowa. Arts, history, and culture ranked number two. And I think the Tourism Bureau, if you go to their website, so much of the marketing material centers around the things to do outside in Iowa, whether it be the state parks or the different water trails, some of the new whitewater parks, the bike trails. It seems like the people are trying to leverage this outdoor industry, if you will.
Well, before we dive into some of the budget cuts that may be down the road and almost certainly are down the road for some of the programs that support these outdoor spaces, let's talk a little bit more about how people are using these spaces. And if this is something that's important to you, we'd love to hear from you, your thoughts on why spaces like this matter in Iowa. 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. I'm talking with Brian Morelli, a reporter for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. And also with me is Ruth Dunleavy. She's president of Backwater Paddlers, which is an Eastern Iowa paddling group. Hello, Ruth.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you.
And Brian profiled your group in the article that he recently published in the Cedar Rapids Gazette. But tell me how you got into kayaking. What drew you to Iowa's rivers?
We just noticed, I got involved with Sea to Sea Water Sports, which is not actually a store anymore in Cedar Rapids, and just doing kayak demos for the store and meeting people. And then we just started kayaking on the different rivers in the Cedar Rapids area. So the more people that we got involved with, 2 years ago, we started a Facebook page, Backwater Paddlers, and we just started meeting more and more people on the rivers, and we're not a livery system. We're just people that go. We meet at a Touch of Class banquets right off. It's in Cedar Rapids. It's a nice big parking lot. The owner lets us use his parking lot, and that way we can throw all the kayaks on, and if we have to travel an hour to an hour and a half, we really like the northeastern rivers. We have so many different rivers that are tributaries to all the major rivers that are... I think what drew us to kayaking is not just the social aspect of it, but the nature and the tranquility of it all, but also the paddling and getting the exercise. You're out and about. It's just a wonderful way to spend the day.
So with Backwater Paddlers, I mean, it's kind of it's a social group. You get together. But for you, paddling on Iowa's rivers, what does the experience bring to you personally?
It brings to me peace of mind, and it also brings to me when I'm out there paddling. That's where I gather all of my blessings for the day. It makes me realize how lucky I am, how blessed I am, And I'm just so thankful when I'm out there. And it's where we all go and praise the earth and really just enjoy that day of being out in the Iowa nature. It's so beautiful. So many people don't understand how beautiful the Iowa countryside and the rivers are. And even just biking the trails along Iowa, you get to see so many things that you can't see from the road. So it brings to me, now that I'm an empty nester, it brings to me something to do where I'm not sitting on the couch at night or during the day. I'm out and about. It brings to me peace and tranquility.
Now, we'll talk a little bit more about how Iowa has invested in some of these trails. Do you see the improvements? Do you see the maps and the investment in making Iowa's rivers a safe place to paddle?
I do see that there is more and more ramps put in. You know, every once in a while you'll come up to a ramp where an Eagle Scout group has put in a ramp for someone, because there are very treacherous areas that you do have to get into a river. So just an easy access is really nice. I'm sure it's impossible to do all the accesses that we go on. But we are seeing more and more better accesses available. Nate's book is a great resource for Iowa paddlers.
And Brian, in your article, you take a look back at how much money the state has invested. What, $7 million on water trails and low head dam mitigation since 2008?
Yeah, I mean, there has been investment in recent years, and that's kind of where the idea for the story came from. It was, you know, I was seeing some improvements in the state, and just kind of, like I said, noticing more and more people out and about, more people, you know, kayaks and canoes on cars, and really seemed like things were, you know, kind of on the upswing. Things were surging as far as popularity of the Iowa outdoors. And I was kind of curious, you know, I wanted to, initially my story idea was to take a look at what kind of impact it was having on tourism, economic development in smaller communities, and, you know, if it was having, kind of moving the needle as far as retention and recruitment of, you know, people to different businesses, you know, trying to get people to come or stay in Iowa. So that's kind of like the impetus for the story. And then as I was reporting, I kind of realized all the different cuts that were happening this year and really in the last couple of years. And it seemed like to be butting heads, right?
Yeah. Well, and we'll kind of detail some of those cuts in a moment. We're going to have to take a short break. With me, Brian Morelli, reporter for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. Ruth Dunleavy is here, president of Backwater Paddlers and Eastern Iowa Paddling Group. Coming up in just a moment, Molly Hansen, executive director of Iowa Rivers Revival, will be joining us. You're welcome to join the conversation as well, 866-780-9100. And this is one of the topics that will be discussed at the Iowa Ideas Conference. It's coming up in downtown Cedar Rapids, September 20th through the 22nd. Many different topics will be discussed during that conference. Iowa Public Radio is a media sponsor for the conference as well. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Valley View Village, an adult community offering a complete continuum of care, including independent living, assisted living, skilled and long-term care. Learn more about this community at valleyviewvillage.org.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. With me this hour, Brian Morelli. He's a reporter for the Cedar Rapids Gazette. He recently published an article about water trails, bike trails in Iowa, how the state has been investing in the past. There are more people enjoying these outdoor spaces than ever before, but there are also many budget cuts on the horizon. So we're talking about these spaces, about why they matter, and taking a look into the future as well. Ruth Dunleavy is also here. She's president of Backwater Paddlers, an Eastern Iowa paddling group. And before we bring Molly Hansen into the conversation here, Brian, we were just talking about how over the last 10 years or 9 years, the state has invested $7 million on water trails and low head dam mitigation. And you started looking into the budget for things like that in the state. In the fiscal year 2018 budget, funding has been slashed to zero for these efforts. So were you surprised when you started looking into the budget cuts?
Yeah, I mean, it did seem like it was kind of a just juxtaposition to all the kind of momentum and sort of investments that had been made and the momentum that had been building for the outdoor, you know, not just outdoor as recreation, but also, you know, preserving the outdoors, conservation and things like that, water quality. And so it was a little bit surprising, especially as I kind of ran through some of the different numbers. Like, for example, you know, the recreational trails budget, which supports bike trails in rural communities, urban communities, all across the state, counties, it had been averaging $2.5 to $5.5 million a year in recent years. That was cut in fiscal 18 to $1 million. The water trails program and Lowhead Dams program, which I guess we didn't really touch on the Lowhead Dams. The Lowhead Dam program is an effort to remove these really dangerous dams that are in the water that, you know, if people get caught up in them, that they can die. It's responsible for dozens of deaths over the last number of years. That program had been cut from, it was $1.75 million in fiscal 2006 and down to zero in fiscal 2018. The Resource Enhancement and Protection, or REAP program, was cut from about $16 million to $12 million. Really, the list kind of goes on and on. The overall budget cuts to the Iowa DNR led to closing the Forestry Bureau. Investment park infrastructure improvements was reduced from $3 million to $2 million. You know, again, it just kind of keeps going on and on.
Absolutely. Well, and looking at some of these budget cuts, are there concerns about maintaining what has been built? I realize that this calls into question the future of building new trails or even continuing projects that have already been started. But also, what about maintenance of the trails that we have?
Yeah, and I think that's what some of the, you know, some of the people I spoke with, that was their concern is, you know, we might not see the impact overnight, but you know, in the years to come, this would kind of disrupt some of the planning efforts that are underway. A lot of these, you know, especially bike trails, take years to kind of acquire land, to design the trail, to build it, and obviously it's not cheap. I think it's like $1 million a mile to build recreational trails. You know, on the water trails front, I mean, it certainly, you know, could slow down some of their efforts. They had been working to try to make the waterways more accessible for people with disabilities, you know, and just kind of more people, you know, kids and maybe families. So some of those efforts would certainly be impacted, according to them.
Well, and of course, there's always Mother Nature as well, because a water trail doesn't always stay once it's been mapped. It doesn't always stay as it was either, right?
Sure. Sure. Yeah, absolutely. The maintenance is another piece of it, you know, keeping the access ramps clear of, you know, if you go on a river. I mean, it's such a big difference having a, you know, a flat pad, a ramp to kind of lower your boat down from versus just kind of a muddy bank and try to, you know, take your chances as you kind of slide into the water. And you know, things like that are make a huge difference for people maybe thinking about whether or not to go out, you know, and explore the state. You know, people who are committed and are just really into it are probably going to do it anyway, but maybe someone who's just kind of thinking about it is going to be deterred.
Well, I want to bring Molly Hansen into the conversation. She's executive director of Iowa Rivers Revival, a nonprofit group dedicated to helping Iowans restore, protect, and enjoy our rivers. Hello, Molly.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Thanks for having me.
Well, and of course, we were just talking about some of these projected budget cuts. I'm sure you've had your eye on them. What are your concerns for the future?
We have. Really, the things that people have said so far are very true. You know, we're seeing more people, more user groups, more diversity of user groups out in our parks and on our rivers. And the more that we can do to make that experience a pleasant one and, you know, a positive one, the more likely they are to continue to do that, which is really where we see the support. especially at the, you know, at the legislative level, at the funding level. And so we have seen these negative trends in funding for programs that we advocate for that have been mentioned, especially the Lowhead Dam mitigation and water trails funding, which we saw zeroed out last session. And really, that's unfortunate because that state funding really serves as, you know, some supplemental funding for projects for communities. You know, we talk about Charles City and Manchester. What that started with was very serious community engagement to, you know, Manchester was a good to great committee, basically. You know, they saw a small to medium-sized town that they, you know, wanted more people attracted to and were kind of bringing their heads together to figure out what was a great way to enhance, you know, the resources that they already had. And so we see these as economic development and ways to attract young families and keep young families in Iowa. And so we'd really like to see the state continuing to support those projects because we just think that the payback is going to be enormous for these communities.
Well, and I'm sure some people listening think, well, if the payback's enormous for these communities, shouldn't the communities just be responsible for making the investment themselves? Why does the state need to be involved from your perspective?
Sure. Well, the communities definitely are involved. I mean, that's the only way that these things get off the ground, so to speak. It has to be, you know, really a group effort. And what we've seen in the past with a lot of these projects is, you know, this groundswell of community support funds an initial level of financing. We see some grants and things like that at community, state, and sometimes federal levels to support that. And those state dollars really just help these projects kind of get over the hump. You know, it's that final piece that turns a plan and a binder to an actual, you know, living, breathing project. And so when we have that kind of public, private, governmental partnerships, you see all this buy-in, and it really does then, you know, pull together and benefit the community as well as the state as a whole.
Well, and Brian, in your article, you also cited the fact that there is this thing called the Iowa Natural Resources and Outdoor Recreation Trust Fund, and this was something that 63% of the voters voted for in 2010 as a way to fund these kinds of projects, but the fund has sat empty since 2010. Tell me a little bit more about that and why it hasn't been funded since the majority of people voted for it.
Well, I mean, I think it's, you know, you could look at any of these funding questions. I mean, it's a matter of, you know, I don't want to say priorities. I mean, it is a matter of priorities, but I mean, there's a lot of different needs, and you know, you start looking at education, just all the different things the state has to pay for, and the funding is tight. So my guess would be that is why it's sat empty. One thing that has gotten some discussion is a proposal for a 3/8 of 1 cent sales tax increase that and allocate that to this trust fund, and that has not been supported. It's, you know, nobody wants to, you know, raising taxes is always a kind of a controversial topic. So you know, we'll see if it gets any discussion during the gubernatorial race. But that, you know, according to one of the groups that Iowa's Water and Land Legacy, which helped kind of formulate this trust, estimates $670 million in unmet needs, they estimate that this raising the tax by 3/8 of a cent would generate about $150 to $180 million annually. So, you know, it certainly wouldn't solve problems overnight, but it seems like it could potentially make an impact, and that's why we're hearing people such as I interviewed State Senator Rob Hoag of Cedar Rapids. He's a Democrat. He was very much supportive of this.
Well, it's interesting in thinking about what you were saying earlier about tourism in Iowa and these communities that have benefited economically from being close to a water trail or a bike trail, something like that. It does seem like this kind of outdoor recreation is getting to be a bigger part of Iowa's identity. Do you feel like that?
Kind of a part of why I thought some of these cuts seem to run counter to some of what was happening around the states. I mean, this is really not an urban versus rural thing. I mean, we have some of the smallest communities are pushing to add bike trails. The number of requests for state recreation trail funding outnumbers the budget, usually 5 or 10 to 1. People or communities around the state are really trying to tap into this because they see some of the potential and they see what some of their neighbors are experiencing. So well, it seems
like a real change in policy. And Molly, from your perspective, let's say I'm not somebody who goes out and kayaks. Why do places like this, why does it matter to the rest of people in Iowa if we are protecting our streams and creating these kind of opportunities for recreation?
Well, Iowa is unique in that it's one of the most altered landscapes in the United States. And so when we look at what, it was before essentially people came and settled the land, we saw a lot of tall grass prairie, oak savannas, natural wetlands, and these really kind of wild spaces. And, the way that the landscape has changed, our river corridors, our creeks, our streams, those really are our last wild spaces. And so when we talk about anything from river restoration to trail enhancement, these are opportunities for us to preserve some of these wild spaces. And maybe it's not necessarily the most active user groups, but, time and time again, we see studies about how people just want to be around water. Cities grew up around water. It's calming. It's an opportunity to be in nature, to be around it, and provides this kind of, this calm, this nature experience. When you look at some of these whitewater courses and even these areas we've done, water trail enhancement projects, there's great amounts of user groups out on the river, but we also see, families and individuals picnicking alongside. We see businesses shoot up, across the street to be conveniently located. We see a town kind of reclaiming an identity around this resource that, maybe they had forgotten about, where a relationship that used to be, an individual just driving over a creek or stream turns into a real connection. And then, in turn, that provides opportunities to get out and recreate, but also just enjoy nature in a safe way.
We have only a couple of minutes left, but Scott Orth is on the line. State Representative Scott Orth. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Charity, how you doing?
Very good. I know this is a subject that's close to your heart. What did you want to add to the conversation?
It's very near and dear to my heart. Hi, Molly.
Hi, Scott.
Here's the thing. REAP was conceived some 27 years ago, and it's in the state code that the legislature is bound by law to appropriate $20 million a year for the REAP program, which helps a lot of things. Our outdoor parks and open spaces. It also helps with historic preservation and et cetera. And the legislature has summarily failed to do that. A couple of years ago, on the 25th anniversary of REAP, I managed to get a $25 million appropriation done through both chambers to kind of celebrate the 25th year and bring funding up a little bit for it. And it got vetoed back to $16 million when it reached the governor's desk. Also, I agree with the reporter, 63% of the population of Iowa has spoken. And, there's a huge groundswell for us to raise that tax to at least 3/8 of a penny. If we raised it a whole penny, we'd have hundreds of millions of dollars left over to put into education and other things that I believe are sorely underfunded and could use some help. So, and I want you to know very clearly, and I want the people of Iowa that are listening to know, that there are many of us in the legislature who care deeply about these things and are willing to move on them. It's just a matter of getting them, enough votes to get it done.
Well, Representative Scott Orth, I'm sure that indicates that this is going to be a matter of discussion again when the legislature reconvenes this year. Brian, obviously a lot of Iowans care about these spaces. Did you find in talking to people for your article that the people who use these spaces are aware of the legislative impact on these spaces as well?
I think it's kind of a mixed bag, because I was asking some questions about, you know, what they thought. And they actually pointed out one of the things that they were most aware of is that some of the river gauges that they use to kind of determine how much the water is flowing and basically which rivers they can use on a given weekend had been shut down due to budget cuts. So there are definitely some awareness, you know, but I think at least the people I spoke with for the article are pretty dedicated. So my guess is they'll continue to use it. But I think they really like bringing new people out with them. So I think they, you know, maybe worry about the appeal of bringing new people out.
Sure. And Ruth of Backwater Paddlers, I see you nodding your head. Is this something that you talk about as you paddle the rivers, or are you just enjoying Iowa's nature?
It is something that we talk about. And we also get together once during the week to discuss where we're going to paddle for the week. We always plan usually on a Wednesday or Thursday because of the water levels to make it safe. But we do have some people with some disabilities. There is a lot of us there that can help them into the water, but
It's
an important issue.
All right. Well, thank you all so much for your time today. Brian Morelli of the Cedar Rapids Gazette, Ruth Dunleavy, president of Backwater Paddlers, and Molly Hansen, executive director of Iowa Rivers Revival. Thank you all.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Thank you.
And this is a topic that will be discussed at the Iowa Ideas Conference in downtown Cedar Rapids coming up on September 20th through the 22nd, a conference where many different issues facing Iowans today and in the future will be discussed. It's organized by the Cedar Rapids Gazette, and Iowa Public Radio is a media sponsor for that event. Coming up in just a moment, I'll talk with someone who has made it his goal to paddle at least one body of water in all 50 states. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We've been talking a lot about Iowa's waterways, and Iowa was state number 31 for Eric Straw. He is on a journey to canoe a body of water in all 50 states this summer. He's doing it to raise money for American Rivers, a national nonprofit dedicated to river protection and cleanup. And he is on the line with me from Seattle. Hello, Eric.
Good morning, Charity. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for being here today.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me.
Tell me how this idea came about.
Oh, man. The inception was just sort of back in college when I started falling in love with canoeing. And I just thought, wouldn't it be neat to do all 50 states? And I kind of thought, I'm going to piecemeal it over several decades. And by the time I'm maybe 60 years old, I've done them all. And then about 8 years went by, and I was at like state number 3. So it clearly wasn't working. Doing it that manner. So I decided just to do it all at once about 2 years ago and started planning. And I set out on April 10th of this year from Texas heading towards Florida, the southeast. And it was basically a big journey to kind of get away from the 24-hour news cycle and take a big risk and get back to nature a little bit and reinvest some faith in the American people.
Well, and you talk about falling in love with canoeing when you were in college. Tell me what your experiences were. What made you fall in love with this?
Sure. And actually, I guess it dates back further than that. It definitely went back to Boy Scout camp, you know, doing a canoeing merit badge and getting to swamp the boat out in the middle of the lake. And we actually had a church youth group, a pastor that took us on these quote-unquote extreme youth trips to Missouri. And we would do these long, about 5 nights, 6 days, canoe tours on this National Scenic Waterway. And I think that was at the very tail end of high school, early college. And that's where I really just decided I liked the idea of floating along the water and, you know, not having a motor along it. And you can just sit there and be as still as you'd like and listen, or you could, you know, goof around with your friends and be as loud as you want as well.
Do you remember a specific experience from one of those trips that made you think, this is what I want to do?
I think of all places, probably being on top of one of these 40-foot cliffs and jumping into the water, which we did, which is not advisable. But the water was clear. We checked the depth. And I think probably being up there and looking down and just seeing how tiny the little canoe was in this grand landscape was kind of a neat thing, just to kind of get the idea of, like, yeah, the boat may look big when you're down in it, but it's really just a small part of this grander thing. And I don't know. Maybe that's where the wheels started turning a little bit.
Well, and why canoeing? Kayaking is extremely popular these days. Why
right.
Why canoeing?
Yeah, I get that a lot, actually. I guess the canoe was, it just felt really classic to me. I had more experience in it. And I am not one of the ultralight packers. I'm not very good at it. You should see my car. There's just stuff everywhere. And with a canoe, you can sort of just toss in another person and as much gear and needless junk as you'd like. And so I really like that. And then plus, when I was down in the southeastern United States where there were sharks, alligators, and the American crocodile in the Everglades, I was very happy to have that extra foot above the waterline.
So you started planning this trip 2 years ago. What kind of research did you do before deciding where you would go in each state?
Sure. I actually, one of the first things I would do is I would just pull up Google Maps, and I would look for riparian corridors or lakes or just anywhere that had a lot of wilderness area that wasn't very developed. And versus going to some of the sites that are like, you know, five best places to paddle, which are great. I've used those as well, too. But I kind of like doing it that way because it made me choose some areas that I wouldn't have been pointed to, a little off the beaten path. So I kind of just looked for areas that were wilderness, specifically areas that had any sort of like conservancy or state forest or national forest land that had public land that I'd be able to camp alongside. Right, that's so, another big aspect.
Right, having a place to stay.
Yeah, and, you know, in certain spots, that becomes trickier, especially in more developed places like the East Coast. And fortunately, I was able to find one in Iowa, so that was good.
Well, and in deciding what body of water you're going to paddle in each state, I mean, first of all, how far do you need to go to make it count?
Yeah, that I think overall I'm going to have over 500, so I'll average 10 a state. But with the way I'm canoeing, which often involves me, like yesterday, jogging back to my car after I've locked my canoe to a tree, a lot of it I have to think about distance just logistically, how I'm going to get back to my car, if I'm going to hitchhike. So I'll look for a body of water maybe that I could potentially paddle upstream and then float back down. So it's funny how distance, some of the easiest floats I've done have been some of the longer and length floats. But some of the more difficult ones, like going to the mangroves, are actually quite shorter, or being on a lake when a big wind kicks up. The distance one, I never really thought about that as much. But once people started asking, yes, I decided, okay, 10 miles on average a state. And I think my longest has been 45. And the shortest on a pond up in Vermont was only, I think, maybe 2.5 miles in complete, just because the pond was only 1.5 miles long. So, but finding a place is difficult because I think I've disappointed people around this country because everyone has their favorite spot to paddle. And even, you know, I'll be in some place. It even happened, I can't remember the name of the river in Iowa, but, you know, I'll tell them I'm going somewhere. And they're like, oh, man, well, you really got to see this one before you go. And I was like, that'd be really nice, but I got to go. So,
you could spend all summer paddling just in one state.
But it's really charming to me. I really like it that people are very passionate about their own particular spot, and they want to share that, even if I've chosen somewhere else. And so that it is funny, but I do really enjoy when people get really excited about, you know, their little pond or their little river.
Well, and when you come to a state, you don't have support? You haven't connected with people before you get here?
Most of the time, no. I usually will call an outfitter or a forest ranger, and I usually do a little bit of, you know, trying to suss out if there's a forest fire, if there's a flood, or how the conditions are, and then I'll pick their brain, I'll ask them some questions. But for the most part, unless I have people, friends or relatives or any sort of family on the ground there, then yeah, I kind of just go in solo, and that's kind of part of the adventure, seeing who I meet and what I run into.
Well, when you decided to come to Iowa, or when you came to Iowa, you decided to go to the White Rock Conservancy near Coon Rapids. How did that get on your radar?
So that actually was one that I investigated before the trip, probably back in maybe even last fall, and it again was a place I was looking through Iowa. And I was looking for it, and I saw there was plenty of rivers, and I was looking for a place with a little bit of topography, a little bit of hills and stuff. There's some views. I always like that. But, of course, I don't want a place that has plenty of rapids because I can't deal with the big rapids. So I was looking for something that's remotely flat water, and I found that spot of green on the map you know, out to the west of Des Moines. And I was able to then, so I kind of had that on my list, and I saw that there was, I looked on Google Maps and or Google Earth, and I could see that there was trees and there was definitely wildland surrounding it. So it looked like a good option. And then when I was getting ready to come up, when I was in Kansas City, fixing the drive up to Iowa, I was able to call the conservancy, and I spoke to a woman there for about half an hour about what I'm doing, and she just gave me all the good advice, and okay, here's where you need to put in, and look out for this. And so they were just very accommodating, very helpful, and it was just, so many times I'll call a place, and they'll be like, you want to do what? Okay, I guess, but this was the exact opposite. They were just very, very excited by the idea, and gave me a lot of good recommendations about where to go. So I had about three or four places on as, you know, backups or other, I don't like to call them backups, but other possibilities for Iowa. But that was the first one I called, and they immediately, I was like, okay, it's done. I'm going there for sure. So.
And now when you were in Louisiana, you had people in Louisiana complaining about Iowa.
Man,
so tell me
I've
about
been
that.
I've been meaning to ask you guys about this. I'm in down in South Louisiana on a river called the Atchafalaya, and I was talking to a couple of old Cajun brothers, and they were giving me a variety of different government conspiracy theories, and it was getting a little bit more unhinged as the conversation went on. And they finally said, "Oh, it's more polluted now. This bayou is more polluted." And I was like, "Oh, it is." And I was like, "Well, where's this pollution coming from?" Thinking they'd tell me some sort of, you know, point source area upstream, a plant, and they just said, "Oh, north." I was like, "North, okay." You know, and they're like, and one guy just blurts out, "Iowa." And I was like, "Iowa?" And they couldn't really give any more details than that, but I told them, I'm like, "I'm going to find out when I'm in Iowa why they're sending all their pollution down to southern Louisiana." So to this day, I have no idea. I just think they thought of a state to the north, and they pinned it all on you guys. So, yeah, you have a... Do you have anything to say on the behalf of Iowa?
Well, not a representative for the entire state of Iowa, although this is a very serious topic, and it's something that we talk about frequently,
sure.
The amount of runoff that makes it to the Mississippi, makes it to the Gulf of Mexico, and contributes to that dead zone. But interestingly enough, when you got here, instead of researching farm field runoff, you ended up digging into the history of Nikita Khrushchev's visit to Iowa in 1959, which
absolutely
took place in Coon Rapids on the Garst farm. Why did mm-hmm. you? Why did you? Why were you drawn to that history?
My sister-in-law is Russian, and my brother, and if I may do a family bragging moment, just got his PhD in Russian studies from the University of Texas in Austin, and. He's fluent in Russian, so he has a very, you know, he's studied this now for, well, what seems like a decade. And so we have a bit of a family connection just to Russia in general. And that was one of the things that came up in conversation when I was speaking to the woman with the conservancy. And I just was like, at first I was like, no, okay. And then I looked into it. And then when I got there, I went to the family house, and there were all these pictures on the wall, all of the newspaper articles of the time. And so... And of course, what's going on with, you know, today with Russian investigations, it just seemed weirdly topical, even though it was from 1959 when he actually stayed on the farmhouse. So I spent probably about an hour just sort of looking around, looking at pictures, looking at books in the Garst homestead, and just was very impressed and kind of blown away. It took me, I wasn't even on the river until about 5 p.m. just because I got kind of caught up and doing my own little exploration. So I don't know what, if anything, I discovered other than that it's just a very interesting thing to have had happened, you know, back at the, you know, the beginning of the Cold War. The leader of the most other powerful adversarial nation just happened to stop into, you know, Coon Rapids, Iowa. And that kind of just blew me away. That's kind of one of the surprises that I like to just, you know, have happened when I'm traveling around the country. So I really enjoy that.
So once you stopped learning about history, you did paddle on the river, on the Raccoon River. Tell me about your experience. What was it like?
Sure. So, yeah, I put in, and it was, like I said, it was probably around 5, and it was July 2nd, I believe. And so everything was kind of ramping up for the 4th. Beautiful sunny day. And the first, where I put in by the bridge, the first maybe mile or so, I was passing by cornfields because just sort of outside of, I believe it was outside the conservancy, or maybe it was even a part of, because I believe they do have a mixture. And then as I kept going, it kind of turned into these larger bur oak trees and bluffs of actually orange-colored bluffs. And I think the white rock was must have been somewhere else because I never actually saw it. But it just, it kind of went through in about the 4.5 miles that I paddled. It went through several different phases as far as just kind of a diversity of, you know, from agriculture. And then it went into this bur oak savanna. And I was told at the conservancy, it's actually the largest, because of the Garth family's, you know, conservation, it's the largest patch of bur oak savanna left in the state of Iowa. And the sun was kind of hitting it at that nice angle you get in the summer evenings. And so there's long shadows being cast by the oaks upon all like the tall grass prairie. And I saw deer, and I didn't see the bald eagles, but I floated under a tree where their nest was under a big cottonwood. So I was really enjoying just, you know, the nature aspect of it. And then I ran into a group of three Iowan kayakers, and they were asking me what I was doing and where I was from, and I said I was from Dallas. And I guess Dallas County, if I'm correct, is right in that area.
Mm-hmm.
And so when I said Texas, they got really, really suspicious of me. And I think they were the first people on the trip to be like, no, you're not doing this. You're just making this up. And I was like, and I was just kind of smiling like you do when you're accused of something. You're like, I'm not making it up.
Right. I don't know how to respond to this.
Right. I just got a big kick of it. So I was like, look, I've got stickers on the front of my boat. And they're like, well, what does that prove? And I was like, well, you're right. Okay. That's not a very good thing. Gave them one of my little, you know, business card things that has my, my blog and all that. And one of them, I think, looked it up and they're like, oh my gosh, we're so sorry. We didn't believe you. And they ended up being great hosts. And they floated with me. Well, one of the guys was, an avid birder. So he was spotting out like scarlet tangers and all these things that I'm just like, I know some species, but he knew them all. So we kind of continued to float. And then I actually ended up pitching my tent with them at their campsite and had a fire, and they made me steak. So they made up for it for sure.
Nice.
They were, we had a great time. So
some of our famous Iowa hospitality.
Then. Exactly. That's what it was about. So
what nice. State are you on now? I know Iowa was 31 for you. How far have you gotten?
I just figured it out yesterday. I'm now at 42, going on 43. I'm in Washington now, and I just canoed on the river 2 days ago, and then I got off actually yesterday afternoon. And yeah, a lot of forest fire smoke out here. I actually had ash raining down upon me yesterday morning while I was making breakfast on a gravel bar, and I was like, this feels pretty ominous. So for the ones I have left, I have basically the rest of the West Coast, so Oregon and Nevada and California. I've got the four corner states to end on, and I actually fly out to Hawaii on September 7th. And that's going to be a fun challenge of finding a canoe that's not an outrigger canoe that's 30 feet long out there.
So, and it has to be a canoe?
I'm assuming I'm going to Oahu. I'm assuming there's a canoe on the island. And someone's going to have a canoe I'll be able to use. But yes, I've spoken to several different outfitters, and they're like, well, we have kayaks because this is the ocean. I was like, yeah, fair point. So if I have to do a kayak, I will do a kayak for you.
Well, Eric Straw, thank you so much for talking with me.
Well, it was my pleasure. Thank you, Charity.
Eric Straw is traveling around the country. He is paddling his canoe in a body of water in all 50 states this summer. He started in April, and Iowa was state number 31 for him. He's doing it to raise money for American Rivers, a national nonprofit dedicated to river protection and cleanup. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbie.